Good day, everyone, and welcome to the IBM DB2 Virtual and Real Storage Conference Call. Today's call is being recorded, and for opening remarks and introductions, I would like to turn the call over to Ms. Diane McCollum. Please go ahead.
Welcome, everybody, to Virtual Storage Release and DB2 Version 8, What to Expect. My name is Diane McCollum, and I am the worldwide sales leader for IBM's DB2 for Z and DB2 and IMS tools. I will be your host today. I am pleased to introduce our speaker from IBM, John Campbell. John, as a distinguished engineer in DB2 for Z development, brings to you an incredible amount of knowledge to this teleconference. Now I'd like to turn it over to John. John?
Thank you, Diane, and welcome to everybody. If you can turn to slide 2, well, actually, we'll just go through the topics we're going to cover in today's session. I'm going to start pretty simply at the beginning by going through the DBM1 64-bit virtual memory map, and then move on and talk about the areas that have been moved above the 2-gigabyte bar in version 8, and talk about thread storage. The next step will be to be able to project version 8 storage usage from existing version 7 statistics trace data. I then want to summarize some key messages before moving on. The next step here then will be to recap about virtual storage constraint problems and the factors that are driving it. We'll then talk about how to analyze the virtual storage usage in your systems. We're going to spend quite a bit of time going through the various tuning options on version 8, and then talk about how to protect the system to defend it. And the last section is going to be about real storage usage in version 8. Now let's turn to slide 3. On slide 3 here, we have a picture of the DBM1 64-bit virtual memory map. I mean, this picture is obviously not drawn to scale. What it shows is that each address space, including the DBM1 address space, now has a range of up to 16 exabytes based on 64-bit addressing. We refer to this as the beam. What you also see is historically that we had what we call the line, which is basically a maximum 16 megabytes available below this 16-megabyte line. We then have the bar at 2 gigabytes, where basically we have up to 2,032 megabytes available between the 16-megabyte line and the 2-gigabyte bar. Prior to version 8, DB2 was a 31-bit system, and basically all the storage was actually either below the bar or below the line. The big thing in version 8 with 64-bit addressing is that a number of storage areas have now been moved above the bar in that area at the top. Now, I've already quoted some numbers here, like 16 megabytes below the line and 2,032 megabytes between the line and the bar. But in reality, the practical maximums are actually much less, because there are common storage areas used by the operating system, ZOS, either side of the line and also below the 2-gigabyte bar. So typically most customers have between 7 and 12 megabytes available below the line for DB2 usage, and they have somewhere between 1,100 and 1,750 megabytes available between the line and the bar itself. Most of the storage areas used by DB2 are allocated in a subpool 229, and this storage is acquired by a get main and then released subsequently by a free main. What DB2 tries to do, basically, is to avoid repetitively get maining and free maining storage, because these operations are actually very expensive. So once DB2 actually acquires storage via a get main, he tries to cache this memory and tries to reuse it logically to avoid having to go through the repetitive physical get main and free main of the storage. Now let's turn to slide 4. On slide 4, you see specifically the 64-bit virtual memory map in version 8 as used by DB2. You can see on the graph here, the picture, the 2-gigabyte bar. What you see here is that most, if not all, of the thread storage is actually below that bar, and also the local dynamic statement cache. Most usage of the local dynamic statement cache is usually small because applications are bound with the bind option, keep dynamic no. But certain application sets, like for example SAP, and also WebSphere applications using JDBC, make use of the bind option, keep dynamic yes. And this means this local dynamic storage cache area can become very significant. The other areas that are below the bar are certain components of the EDM pool and the RID pool. So to cap again, most of the thread storage, the local dynamic statement cache, and some portion of the EDM pool and the RID pool components still remain below the 2-gigabyte bar. Above the bar now, in version 8, we have moved buffer pools, the control blocks, cast out buffers, certain parts of the RID pool. We've moved the DVD cache and also the prepared statement cache from the EDM pool above the bar. The sort pool is moved up there. Some of the trace tables have moved up, the accounting blocks, the compression dictionaries, and also the IRLM locks. significant amount of area is therefore moved above the bar, which hopefully should generate a lot of virtual storage constraint relief below the bar. Now let's turn to slide 5. Now to try and summarize what's happening here, as I said before, most of the thread storage stayed below the 2GB bar in version 8, but there was some regression, and this was expected because of 64-bit pointers, long names, and actually Unicode. So even if you're not actually using Unicode, DB2 is operating on Unicode internally. So the three main areas to consider below the bar in version 8 are the agent local storage, which is broken into two subcomponents, agent local system, which is related to system engines such as deferred writes and cast out and prefetch engines. And then we've got a thing called agent local non-system, and this is related to the user thread storage, either local allied threads or distributed DBATs. The second major area below that bar is the get main stack storage, and then the local dynamic statement cache. Now, as I said, there was some regression in these areas in version 8, and what I've done on the second half of this slide is provide you with some high-level rules of thumb for basically what that regression amounts to. Let's first of all look at the agent local storage. What we've observed is basically 40% regression for the system threads, and for the non-system threads, it depends on whether you're using primarily static versus dynamic SQL. For static SQL, we're seeing somewhere between 30 and 40% regression, and dynamic SQL between 50 and 100%. Get main stack storage, from a very small base, has actually increased by 2x. In the area of the local dynamic statement cache control blocks, these control blocks basically are used to track prepared statements in the EDM global cache. What we're seeing in version 8 here is actually a 75% reduction. So not regression here, actually a reduction. The actual thread copies of the cached SQL statements, this is the local dynamic statement cache. And basically here we see a 100% increase in that in version 8. Now the EDM pool in version 8 is split into three components. The actual database descriptors and the prepared statement cache, otherwise known as the global cache, they've been moved above the bar. But the remaining EDM components like package tables, cursor tables, the skeleton package tables, and the skeleton cursor tables, they still remain below the bar. Now, let's take two scenarios here. First of all, a customer migrates to version 8 without rebinding any plans and packages. What will happen, therefore, is that these objects will get puffed up to look like V8 equivalents. And so in actual fact, there will actually be no savings in the EDM pool below the bar. But the second scenario is when you actually do rebind incrementally all your plans and packages on version 8. And once that you start to do this, then you'll see an increased requirement for EDM pool storage below the bar. And what I've seen typically is somewhere between 30 and 50% increase in EDM pool storage in version 8 after people have done mass rebinds of all their plans and packages. So some of the RID pool has actually been moved above the bar, and we have seen typically up to 75% reduction in the RID pool resource requirement. And in other areas, because we've moved them above the bar, we've seen a 100% reduction to eliminate them. Now let's turn to slide 6. What I've tried to do to help you and other customers is basically provide you with a high-level way of trying to project how things would look on version 8 before you actually migrate to it. And what you see on this picture here on the left-hand side is a description of the storage areas, starting with virtual buffer pool and working its way all the way down to stack storage. And then in column 2, we've got what's been measured on version 7. And this information can be provided from the DB2 PM or PE or equivalent monitor or Megamon performance expert. These values can be pulled and actually just simply transcribed into the spreadsheet. Now in column 5, there are actually a set of notes. And these notes basically document what changes, what calculations are applied to the V7 measured values to project what it would be on version 8. So what you can see here, if we go down the rows here, is that the virtual buffer pool, the buffer pool control blocks, and the data space look-aside buffer, these have been moved above the bar, completely above the bar in version 8. And that's why the version 8 estimated value is 0. Now, in the case of the EDM pool, we're talking here about a 30 to a 50% increase. So if we assume the worst case here of, say, 50%, you can see that the EDM pool resource requirement below the bar has increased from 88 megabytes to 124. You see that for compression dictionaries and cast-out buffers, these have been moved completely above the bar, so therefore the value is 0. And basically, as you work your way down this spreadsheet here, you can see from the notes what calculations are actually applied to each of the storage areas. Now let's turn to slide 7. On slide 7, here's a picture here showing the potential value of version 8 DBM1 64-bit virtual support. I'm using this picture here as a way of illustrating the potential benefit to customers. Now, what you have on the y-axis here is the amount of megabytes used below the bar and above the line in the DBM1 address space. And then what we have is a set of customer scenarios. Now, the top of the yellow here is basically the maximum available extended region size available to the address space, including DB2 and the DBM1 address space. And the first thing you notice is that the top of the yellow varies by customer. And the reason why it varies is that each customer has different size extended common areas. Now, if you look at customer 3 in this scenario, you can see that basically they've only got 1190 megabytes available. This customer runs IMS, IMS Transaction Manager. An IMS Transaction Manager is a big user of extended CSA, because that's where a lot of control blocks go and also where the buffers go, the data buffers. And obviously, large amounts of data buffers are key to IMS performance. So one of the pressure points on many customers is increasing requirement for storage in this extended common areas. But the downside of this is it reduces the extended private area available to DB2 and other started tasks and address spaces. So you can see it's highly variable across these customers. The top of the red here is the version 7 use. So you can actually see, for most of these customers, their comfortable headroom. However, the customer on the right-hand side, you can see there's very little yellow there, and also the one before that only has a reasonable amount of yellow as well. The top of the blue is the version 8 use. And apart from those two special cases on the right-hand side, you can see that most customers get a lot of virtual storage constraint relief on version 8. The customer on the left-hand side is also a special case. This customer did not use data space buffer pools under version 6 and version 7. And what you can see for a customer like this is you see the most dramatic savings on version 8. That's not really typical, but customers 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 here, and 7, you can see that they get a healthy relief in version 8, somewhere between 10 to 40% virtual storage constraint relief, which is most welcome. Now, the two customers on the right-hand side, you'll notice that you can't see any red. And the reason for this is that basically they got no relief from version 8. You can't see the red because it's hiding behind the blue. And clearly the customer on the right-hand side is in deep trouble here because basically you can hardly see any yellow. I want to stress, these are special cases. For most customers, vast majority of customers, they will get some degree of virtual storage constraint relief in version 8. And the technique I showed you on the previous slides was a way of you being able to project where you would be on version 8 based on version 7 statistics data. And in fact, although this chart shows a series of projections, several of these customers now have safely migrated to version 8, running very smoothly, and the projections were very much in line with the actuals. And although those two customers on the right-hand side look that they're in trouble, both of them have successfully migrated to version 8, and both now have generous virtual storage headroom based on some of the tuning options that I'm going to talk about later in this presentation. Now let's turn to slide 8. What I want to do so far now is just summarize some of the key messages so far. First of all, DBM1 64-bit virtual support will provide valuable virtual storage constraint relief for most installations. The actual value of DBM1 virtual storage constraint relief will vary by installation, and hopefully now in this presentation I give you a technique to be able to estimate where you will be after you've migrated to version 8. But we have to be clear here, DBM1 64-bit support does not eliminate the problem. It provides valuable headroom, but with organic growth in your businesses and also mergers and acquisitions and things like LPAR consolidation, this valuable headroom may actually get eaten up. So for most installations, it's still very, very important to continue to capacity plan for, monitor and tune, and optimize the use of virtual storage below the 2 gigabyte bar in the DBM1 address space. Something else I want to remind you of and reinforce later is that you must have sufficient real storage to fully back the increased total virtual storage requirement. Once you've migrated to a 64-bit real and now a 64-bit virtual environment, it is absolutely critical that you have little or no paging activity on your system, and therefore you're running almost in a virtual equals real environment, and you must have sufficient real storage. And this includes both the storage below the bar and, most importantly, above the bar as well. So although in many cases here we've actually reduced the storage requirement below the bar and moved things above the bar, the actual total requirement, adding together both the below the bar requirement and the above the bar requirement, is much greater than it was in version 7. So for most customers, you will be able to support some additional number of active threads and DBATs, and many of you who were horribly storage constrained on version 6 and version 7 and had to use these things called thread storage contraction and the best fit algorithms, which are triggered by constore and minstore's EPROMs, you may now well be able to actually set them to no, which actually give you some CPU savings. Those are some interim key messages. Now let's turn to slide 9. So what I want to do now is just simply recap about the basic problem and how it may manifest itself and the factors that are driving it. So what is the DBM1 problem? DB2 uses get mains and free mains to first of all acquire and then free storage usage. These requests may be either conditional or unconditional, and a short on storage condition can actually occur for either type of request. In many cases, the DB2 recovery teams will be able to come in and clean up. Now, as a customer gets storage constrained below the bar in the DBM1 address space, individual DB2 threads, both local threads, allied threads, or DBETs, may append with a reason code of EC2000-something if there's insufficient storage available. Some examples of this are EC2000-3 and EC2000-16. These are individual threads appending. But eventually, if you try to pour a quart into a pint pot and really overcommit the storage, then basically the subsystem will append with either a system 878 or a system 80A append when a critical task is running, must complete, and basically cannot tolerate a failure when it comes to storage. An example of a must complete activity is something that runs in SRB mode, like, for example, a commit or a rollback. And any must complete function must get a storage requirement satisfied. Otherwise, what DB2 does is he appends the total subsystem, and he does this in order to protect and provide data integrity. Now let's turn on to slide 10. So what's actually driving this? And on the next few slides here, we've got some examples of things that are actually driving it. First of all, workload growth. Most customers are growing at about 20 to 30% per annum in terms of their storage requirement. Some of that is organic growth within the business, but some of it is also coming through mergers and acquisitions. In other words, trying to pour more work into an existing system, both a subsystem or a data sharing group. One of the other phenomena is the shrinking of the maximum region size extended private available to DB2. And here you can see a conflict between IMS, for example, which is a big user of ECSA, and DB2, which is a big user of extended private. And basically, one of the issues here is that IMS is a big user of ECSA for buffer pools, control blocks, etc. Whilst the sizes are at user choice, for best performance, customers who are using IMS tend to over-allocate ECSA to get better performance and have larger data buffers. And so if you are an IMS customer, one thing you need to consider here is exploiting all the virtual storage constraint features of recent IMS releases as well, so you can reduce your ECSA requirements and then have an increased extended private area that you can give to DB2, CICS, and so on. Many customers have also gone through LPAR consolidation. Because of the larger, faster Z990 and Z9 processors, many customers are looking to consolidate the number of LPARs. Now, as part of the LPAR consolidation, if they also try to consolidate their DB2 members, then basically they're trying to put more work in terms of threads through those systems, and that is also one of the drivers. There are also other users of extended common areas, such as WebSphere, which is driving up the requirement for the extended common area and reducing the size of the extended private area. Some customers as well have been over-allocating ECSA in other extended common areas. Now, for any ZOS systems programmer, one should make sure there's an adequate free space, if you like, or buffer in ECSA. Typically, people tend to allow something like a 25% buffer. But if you're continually having free space in extended CSA much above 25%, and this is obviously one of the tuning areas we can talk about later, which is to reduce the size of ECSA and get that space back to the extended private area. It's also worth recognizing that if you are a Parallel Cisplex customer and following best practices, then you actually want to have a common LPAR design. So you can actually move services and subsystems around the various LPARs of the group. So basically, you need to have a common LPAR design to be able to do that. And clearly then, the system that has the biggest requirement from ECSA, that is the system that will effectively determine the LPAR image and the size of the extended private area. Let's continue on slide 11. Here are some other specific items, and I've actually highlighted by underlining some of the key words. One is actually the increase in the average thread footprint across successive DB2 releases. So from first of all version 6 to version 7, and then version 7 to version 8, the size of an average thread footprint actually increased by about 20 to 30% on each of those releases. Another aggravating factor is long-running persistent threads, particularly those that are running with release deallocate. So examples of these long-running persistent threads are IMS wait for input regions, KIX protected entry threads, a WorkSphere connection pool, and a DDS connection pool. These are long-running persistent threads. And once they get allocated, they stay there. And if on top of that, there are plans and packages running on those persistent threads that are bound with release deallocate, then you have a situation where basically through the combination of persistent threads and release deallocate, one can end up with very fat threads. The next option here, or driver, is basically increasing use from some customers of the bind option keep dynamic yes and having a large value for the ZPOM max keep D. Keep dynamic yes means that dynamic SQL statements persist beyond the commit and they're stored actually on the thread in an area which I'll refer to as a local dynamic statement cache, and max keep D is actually the throttle, which actually controls how many statements at a total system level are kept in that local dynamic statement cache. So things like WebSphere using JDBC, many customers are using the local dynamic statement cache through keep dynamic yes as a way of reducing the number of short prepares. Each short prepares about 10 to 15,000 instructions, and therefore, I've seen in several cases where customers save maybe 15, 20% of their total CPU by using keep dynamic yes. But it's a trade-off here between CPU and storage. And also ERP CRM applications like SAP are also big users of key dynamic yes to try and avoid these short prepares. Another trend as well, for some time, has been customers setting Cthread and Max DBAT throttles to very high values. Now, prior to version 7, I can understand why a customer did this, because prior to version 7, there was not an online ZPALM change, so you could change these values dynamically without recycling DB2. With version 7, an online ZPALM change, you could actually change these values on the fly. And the problem is in that many, many customers, basically, have Cthread Max DBAT set so high that these throttles are basically ineffective. And if there are system slowdowns and more workload keeps arriving and more threads come into play, then basically it's a race condition between whether the EDM pool itself blows in terms of space or the DBM1 address space itself blows. And finally, a factor as well, is anything that degrades the DB2 activity time. And by the DB2 activity time, I mean the counting class to elapsed time. So basically there are degradations in IO response time, TF service times, or application lockouts occur, this would extend the accounting class to elapsed time. And if the workload keeps rising at the same rate, that means more threads come into play. And when more threads come into play, this can drive the resource utilization up, the usage of storage. And ultimately, if Cthread and Max DBAT are set so high, this means the whole subsystem could come down, which is obviously a serious availability hit. Let's turn to slide 12. I want to try and summarize this now and say, well, and I'll use this emotive term here, the deadly combination. If you're a customer who's made maximum use of data space buffer pool under version 7 and converted all your primary buffer pools to data spaces, that you have many concurrent persistent threads, and that you're either using keep dynamic yes or widespread use of release deallocate, and your Cthread and Max DBAT throttles are wide open, and you maybe have migrated very quickly from version 6 through version 7 to version 8. If you've got 4 or 5 of these factors here, you need to pay particular attention when you're migrating to version 8 and use the spreadsheet model technique that I've outlined earlier in this presentation to project what the position would be on version 8. We now turn to slide 13. I've given you here some broad rules of thumb here for the thread storage footprint. What I'm saying here is that for very simple static SQL, the low end is somewhere between about 200 to 400 kilobytes. But the mid-range applies to most static SQL and simple dynamic SQL is the thread footprint is between 500 kilobytes and 2 megabytes. And for the high end, when you have very complex dynamic SQL, heavy sort and query parallelism, then we're talking about 3 to 10 megabytes per thread, and in fact it could be a lot more than that, especially with a high degree of parallelism. So what you can see here is that the thread storage footprint, the amount of storage per thread, varies dramatically depending on the type of workload that you're running. And you also can see that in most installations, most customers will never be able to run more than somewhere between 300 to 800 concurrent threads through the system. So mileage will actually vary wildly by installation. Now let's turn to slide 14. What I want to do on this chart and the follow-on charts is the most important thing is to make well-informed decisions. First of all, as to know whether you've got a problem, but then having found you may or may not have a problem, if you do have a problem, you then want to understand at a more detailed level how the storage is being used so you can make some well-informed tuning decisions. So on slide 14, first thing I want to talk about here is RMF. Now, the RMF facility gives you a way of analyzing the storage at a very high level. And the first thing to do is to run the virtual storage report for the private area. This data is collected in SMF with a type 72-2 record. The actual collection of the data is triggered by a monitor one session option, which is shown here, where you say use the vstore command and you specify the name of the DBM1 address space. And then in order to produce the report, you specify the reports keyword to the RMF post processor. The collection of this data for an individual address space like DBM1 is actually very cheap. So from a very high-level viewpoint or perspective, in order to identify potential shortages, it's a good idea to actually run this report. Although with the enhancements that have been made in DB2 with IFCRD 225, this is not essential. Any information you actually need from an RMF report, you can now get in IFCRD 225 and get that produced by the DB2 Performance Expert or DB2PM or the new Omegamon XE product for DB2. What I've given you here is also a calculation to try and calculate the available storage. And on the next chart, we're actually going to look at a real example and apply that formula. At the end of the day, when we get the result, if you find you've got more than 500 megabytes spare, this is a green condition. Everything is good. You've got better things to do. If it's between 200 and 500 megabytes, then I call this a boundary condition or an amber condition, which means you need to pay some attention. But if it's less than 200 megabytes available, then you're actually in deep weeds. You're in the red zone here, and some urgent action is required to better understand the storage and to take some tuning action to generate some headroom. Let's now turn to slide 15. Here is an example of the private area summary report produced by the RMF post processor. What I've done on this chart here is highlighted some areas in green. These areas here, and the highlight behind it, reflects basically the formula on the previous page. What we're doing here is taking the region assigned and available to DB2, the extended private area, which in this case is 1635 on the top right-hand corner, and what we're doing is subtracting away from that the 31-bit low private area at 24.6 megabytes and the high private area of 1089. And we do that calculation, and as you can see in this case, this customer has 521 megabytes free. So they're in the green zone here, and they've got plenty of available virtual storage. What I've done here as well is I've highlighted some areas in red. Now this says unused. Now you need to be careful here about the semantics about what this means. If you see values here like unused of 0 and 0, this does not mean what you think it does. It doesn't mean unused. Because unused of 0, you would think, means there's no storage available. So do not use those fields to determine how many storage is available. You've got to go through this calculation I've just gone through. Now, for those of you who are really observant, you're going to tell me that when it says unused 521 megabytes there in red, it's exactly the same as the calculation. Yes, that's absolutely true. It just means that I picked a bad example report. But I can tell you there are situations where basically those two values vary wildly, and you must go through the calculation I've just articulated. Let's turn to slide 16. One of the big things we did in DB2 in version 6, and then we introduced it and extended it further in version 7 and now version 8, is we've provided support in DB2 instrumentation with IFC ID 225, which provides summary information on virtual storage usage for DBM1, and also IFC ID 217, which provides you detailed information at the thread level. In most cases, you'll be able to do your work based on IFC ID 225. IFC ID 225 is summary information. It's very cheap to produce in terms of CPU and in terms of SMS data volume. The overhead is tiny. So you get a snapshot as each DB2 statistics interval becomes due. It's now available through DB2 Statistics Trace Class 1. Previously, you had to have Statistics Trace Class 6 turned on. But after an APAR on version 7, all you have to do is run Trace Class 1. Tiny overhead, and the recommendation is to always run with Statistics Trace Class 1, and this will automatically therefore collect IFC ID 225. And the recommendations are that the EPAM stat time to 5 minutes, so this record is cut at every 5-minute interval. For a description of these IFC IDs, I recommend you look in DSNW messages in the library that's provided on the slide. IFC ID 217 is very detailed information at the thread level. From a CPU perspective, it's very cheap to produce, but it will produce an awful lot of data. And so, basically, I would recommend that in most cases, you just stick with IFC ID 225 and only use IFC ID 217 if you really need to drill down at a very detailed level. Now turn to slide 17. Now the question is, having created all this IFC ID 225 data, how are you going to post-process it? Well, one of the first ways to do this is to actually use some of the IBM tools. So tools like Omegamon XE for DB2, DB2PM and DB2PE provide really first-class support. They do it in three particular ways. First of all, the statistics trace and report set include file and load commands, so you can actually extract this data and actually load it into DB2 tables. The normal DB2 statistics trace report layout long will also provide a detailed information about information that's on the IFC ID 225. With the record trace report set, you can be able to print out and get the detailed information for both IFC ID 217 and 225. And most recently, we've introduced a new subcommand in DB2PM, PE, and also Omegamon XE for DB2, whereby this command called the spreadsheet DD subcommand enables DB2PM or Omegamon to produce for you a .csv file, a spreadsheet file that you can load immediately into Microsoft Excel. So this is fairly recent news, and on the chart here, I've listed the APARs and the levels of the products where you actually get this support. And this support is available right now. The other option for those customers who do not have or are lucky enough to have these tools is there are some Rex tools which have been available for myself from some time. These tools are now available for download from the DB2 Trading Post, which is off the DB2 for ZOS homepage. So if you go into Google and search the DB2 Trading Post, you will find, first of all, where the Trading Post is in terms of the respective web page, and you'll be able to search through there to actually find the Rex tools and the documentation that goes with them. And all updates to those tools are actually always put on the DB2 Trading Post. Now turn to slide 18. On slide 18 is a sample statistics trace or statistics report layout long from Omegamon and DB2PM or DB2 Performance Expert. One of the most important things about this chart is the indentation. So let me just talk about the blue items first of all. First of all, it tells you what the total DBM1 storage usage is below the 2 GB bar, and that's 773 megabytes. On the right-hand side there, it tells you what the extended region size is available to DB2 and any other address space. So as you can see here, there's over 1,000 megabytes, or just slightly less than 1,000 megabytes available. It also tells you what the extended CSA size. And now DB2PM, Performance Expert, and Omegamon, they now calculate the average thread footprint for you for that interval, and also the theoretical maximum number of threads, which in this case was 3.6 megabytes and 236 threads, respectively. Now, I said the indentation was important. So now if you look at the actual green items here, you can see that if you take the total get main storage, the total variable, the total fixed storage, the total get main stack storage, and the 31-bit extended low private area, if you add those five items together, it comes approximately equal to the total DBM1 storage. And I use my words carefully there. I said approximately. Obviously, something like storage consumption by DB2 is an extremely complicated area. And all we do with IFCID 225 and also this report is we report on the most significant areas. We don't report on every single area. So if you do that calculation, you will not get an exact number that adds up to 773, which is the total DBM1 storage. But those five areas are the major consumers. Now I want to drill down on the total variable storage area. From both a capacity viewpoint and also if there's a potential defect in this space, it's important to identify what is consuming the storage in that area. And again, what I've done here is I've highlighted in red the individual components that get added up together to calculate the total variable storage. Again, if you add those numbers together, you don't get a precise number equal to the total variable storage. There will be some shortfall. But what you can see here, if you add together the total agent local storage, RDS op pool, RID pool, pipe manager subpool, and local dynamic statement cache control blocks, plus the thread copies of the cached SQL statements, if you add those together, it's approximately equal to the total variable storage. And now, if you go inside the total agent local storage, it's further subdivided into the total agent system storage and the total agent non-system storage. So you can see the breakdown between system threads like prefetch engines, deferred writes, and also the number of user threads, the allied and threads and DBATs used by user applications. Now let's turn to slide 19. Now clearly that report we just looked at in the previous slide could have applied to version 7, version 8, and version 9. What I've done here is to try and take that information on the previous slide and map it specifically onto version 8. And what you can see here is the total DBM1 storage used is a combination of those four areas plus the 31-bit low private, and we have a storage cushion. A storage cushion is basically free storage that's readily available. It's a buffer. So basically, one of the recommendations I'm going to give you later is going to be that you need to keep a storage cushion of about 200 megabytes spare for various reasons. What I've done here is I've actually grayed out those areas in both get, main, and variable that have moved above the bar in version 8. So the things that are still in bold black here are the items that are still there in version 8. So if you look at the total get mains, all the areas, apart from the EDM pool, have been moved above the bar, and are still a subset of EDM pool still remains below the bar in get main storage. And if you look at the total variable storage, the total agent system storage, the total agent local, some of the RID pool, the pipe manager sub pool, the local dynamic statement cache, those areas still remain below the bar. Now let's turn to slide 20. One of my objectives, and what I want you to do, is I want you to study storage and be able to do it easily. And you can't just study storage by looking at any one interval. You need to study the evolutionary trend. So one of the objectives of the enhanced support in Omegamon, DB2 Performance Expert and DB2 PM is to be able to create data that can be loaded easily into a spreadsheet. And that's why there's that new subcommand called the spreadsheet DD statement, which enables you to create a .csv file that you can actually load into Microsoft Excel and then add additional formula and also be able to graph the results. So same thing with the memusage tool, MEMU2. Again, it provides a nice, easy way to write out a comma-delimited file that you can then easily import into Microsoft Excel and then produce graphs and also provide additional calculations. So here's a sample spreadsheet. I just want you to focus here on the green area. The green area is data that came from IFCID 225. The actual sequence of the columns and which columns are being shown here depend on how you decide to model the spreadsheet. In this case, I've actually just shown a subset of the columns for brevity. The area on the right-hand side, which is in red, these are fields that were added later. And in the second half of this presentation, I will talk about those calculations and how those columns are derived. And what you do see as well here is an actual graph which shows the evolutionary trend of various storage areas over time. But I will cover that more later. But the key message I want to give you here is that when you're studying virtual storage usage, you need to study the evolutionary trend over successive statistics intervals. And the only easy way to do that is to write out the IFCID 225 record into either a .csv file or a comma-delimited file that can then be easily loaded into Microsoft Excel, and then it makes it very easy to do these calculations and also to graph the results. Let's turn to slide 21. What I've got here is a list of tuning options that you can use to actually try and tune the virtual storage. I'll be going through these one at a time. And later on, I'd like to think about, particularly in this area, if you have particular questions later on, I'd like to save them up, and then we can go through them at the end of this presentation. With most of these tuning options, we're actually trading CPU in order to reduce storage. In other words, CPU will increase in order to reduce the storage consumption. So what I'm going to do now is go through these tuning options one at a time. Let's turn now to slide 22. In slide 22, I want to talk about full system storage contraction. This is not so much a tuning option here as actually a reserve parachute. DB2 actually put some logic in back in version 6 to implement a storage cushion, and we've made some changes to that over time. And the idea of the storage cushion is that once, basically in your system, you encroach on the storage cushion because the amount of available storage has reduced below that cushion size, then DB2 has a thing called full system storage contraction, where DB2 actually tries to reduce that storage or free it off in order to keep the system alive. You should view this as a reserve parachute. You do not want to be bouncing in and out of that storage cushion on an ongoing basis, because if you do, it will burn CPU, and therefore there's a danger as well. You're putting a lot of stress on the system, and it may lead to breakage. Now, on this chart here, I've given you some calculations about what DB2 does internally. There are really three areas here: PVT crit, PVT MVS, and PVT SOS. Let's go through them one at a time. PVT crit is often referred to as either MVS cushion or storage from us complete. It's a fixed real value, and it's driven by the ZPOMs or DPOMs, Cthread and MaxDBAT. And this PVT crit area is calculated as Cthread plus MaxDBAT plus 1 times 64K. Now, I've highlighted 64K here because that is the size of the stack storage element in version 8. Prior to version 8, the stack storage element was only 20K. So I need to give you a health warning here. If you migrate to version 8 and you've set Cthread and MaxDBAT really high and even to the maximum, then you will have the effect, as you'll see in a minute, where you will inflate the size of the storage cushion. I've already seen a number of cases on version 8 where customers have set Cthread and MaxDBAT to the max, where the size of the storage cushion is over 300 megabytes. And clearly, that is far too high. So if you're a customer who has been in the habit of setting Cthread and MaxDBAT really high and not defending the system, be warned, in version 8, if you do that, you will inflate the size of the storage cushion and be driving full system contraction frequently. The second area is PVT MVS, sometimes referred to as either MVS available or storage for MVS. This is a reserved area set aside for data set opens. It's driven by DS Max, and the area is adjusted up and down as data sets get opened and data sets get closed. And the calculation is basically DS Max, ZPOM, times 1300, plus 40K. The next key area is PVT SOS, sometimes referred to as MVS warning to contract or cushion warning. This is a maximum of 5% of the extended region size and PVT crit, which was calculated earlier. Prior to version 8, in most cases, PVT SOS was really 5% of the extended region size. But like I said a few minutes ago, if you set basically Cthread and MaxDBAT really high, then in version 8, PVT crit will become the dominating factor in that calculation for PVT SOS. So at the bottom there in red, I've repeated my warning here that the storage cushion is a summary or the addition of those three areas: PVT SOS, PVT crit, and PVT MVS. And those three areas added together, that is the storage cushion size. Now turn to slide 23. On this slide 23 here, I'm showing an example based on a real customer example, but from version 7. The fact it's on version 7 is really not significant. I'm simply using it as a way of illustrating the various thresholds that you reach. Now, the color pattern here is significant. It starts off as green, which means everything is okay. It goes through orange, and eventually it goes to red. One of my strong recommendations is to keep 200 megabytes spare as a basic storage cushion. This is nothing to do with the storage cushion calculation I've just talked about. It's simply something based on John Campbell's recommendation. You should try to keep 200 megabytes spare at all times. And the rationale behind it is that you want to avoid hitting the real storage cushion. You also want to have enough storage headroom so you can monitor and tune. You also exploit fast log apply, and you also have some headroom for growth and tuning. So basically, the idea is to keep the basic storage cushion at 200 megabytes, and that way you never get into the deep orange and the red zone. If you do not observe that recommendation, The next thing you're likely to hit here is the storage cushion, which is the summary of those three values calculated on the previous slide. Once we encroach on the storage cushion, what DB2 will do basically is trigger full system contraction. It's a way of trying to keep the system alive. And whilst that's occurring, you'll see an increase in DBM1 TCB time. The next area, if DB2 is actually running out of storage, is that basically you'll hit the storage critical condition, which is a summary of PVT crit and PVT MBS. Now again, if you set C-thread and max DBAT really high, this will inflate the storage critical threshold. And this threshold is really important. Once that storage critical threshold is actually reached, what happens then is that any request for storage will be rejected by DB2 unless it's for a must-complete function. And this is where threads will start to append with a reason code 00EC2 like 3 or 15 or something like that. And then finally, you'll hit the maximum region size. Once you've encroached on this thing called storage critical area, if the storage request for an individual must-complete function cannot be honored, DB2 will then append. So clearly you can see here that once you start hitting the cushion and threads start abending, you are very close to the end of the road. Now let's turn to slide 24. Now I'd like to talk about thread storage contraction. Thread storage contraction is triggered by a ZEPROM called constore, and it must be set to a value of yes in order to drive thread storage contraction. There is some CPU overhead associated with it, but it's typically very small. The design point for this is long-running persistent threads with release commit. This thread storage contraction will not be helpful at all if, for example, you're using release deallocate everywhere, because with release deallocate, you're actually saying, please do not free off the storage. So the effectiveness of thread storage contraction, and for that matter, the full system contraction on the previous slide, is all based on the assumption that there are available blocks of storage that are available to be freed off. So if you use release deallocate everywhere, this thread storage contraction function will have little or no value. Secondly, this thread storage contraction compresses out part of the agent local non-system storage. So if your storage constraint is heavily driven by storage areas other than agent local non-system again, this will not be very effective. So thread storage contraction focuses on compressing out part of the agent local non-system storage. It does not compress agent local system or get main stack storage or the local dynamic statement cache. So this item, this tuning option, needs to be applied as and when there is benefit. It is controlled by two hidden ZEPROMs, which in version 8 are set to 1 megabyte as the storage threshold and 10 commits as the commit threshold. And thread storage contraction is triggered based on the formula at the bottom of this chart. So basically, if the number of commits is greater than 10, or the agent local non-system is greater than 1 megabyte, and it's 5 commits is the last contraction. If one of those two conditions is true, then thread storage contraction will be driven. Now let's turn to slide 25. We also have a thing called a best fit algorithm for thread storage. It's controlled by a ZEPROM called minstore. The default is minstore equals no, which means it will use the existing first fit algorithm. In some cases, fragmentation may happen with free space. I call it the leapfrog effect. And basically, when you run with the default of the first fit algorithm, in some cases you may see a lot of fragmentation. What minstore equals yes does, it applies a best fit algorithm. When this happens, what will happen in storage allocation is DB2 will go through all its chains across all the segments looking for the best fit. Now, this obviously requires more CPU resource. Typically, for small storage pools of 3 to 4 megabytes, this is very tiny. The effect of minstore and the yes and the best fit algorithm is to actually make storage denser. But I also want to point out, this is not like some magic solution. If you do have a storage leak, minstore equals yes is a bit like a band-aid, an elastoplast. It has the effect of masking storage leaks. It makes them appear to go away. It makes the storage leak more shallow. So it can be viewed as a really good solution, but you need to apply it carefully. It also makes debugging storage leaks more difficult itself, and if the storage leak progresses, then basically the storage chains will get longer and it will lead to degraded performance. However, minstore equals yes is a valuable tool to use, provided the system is already fully tuned and optimized for storage usage, you have determined there are no leaks, and you've exhausted all other options and need the last amount of storage usage, then minstore equals yes is a very good option. Now let's turn to slide 26. Two particular application types now are starting to make use of the local dynamic storage cache, and this is driven by the bind option keep dynamic yes. And from a purely CPU performance objective, what these type of applications are trying to do is to reduce the number of short prepares. And basically, let's take some numbers here just to illustrate this. Let's assume that a typical SQL statement, static SQL statement, for insert, update, delete, and a single row select is between 25 and 55,000 instructions. A full prepare, which is a miss in the global cache, is extremely expensive because it can add up to 300,000 instructions. But even if you get a hit in the global cache, then there's still a cost of the short prepare. The short prepare is where a statement is copied from the global cache onto the thread. And a short prepare is somewhere between 10 and 15,000 instructions. So the usage of keep dynamic yes in the local dynamic statement cache is to avoid that overhead. But unfortunately, in many situations now, like with WebSphere and JDBC, and also some of the ERP applications like SAP, this local dynamic statement cache area has become huge below the bar. So one of your tuning techniques here is actually to do some trading here. In other words, reduce the size of the local cache by reducing max keep D, and at the same time actually increase the size of the EDM prepared statement cache above the bar, otherwise known as the global cache. And what you're trying to do here very simply is, on one hand, you're going to reduce down max keep D incrementally, even to zero, as a way of trying to reduce the size of the local dynamic statement cache. As you reduce the size of the local dynamic statement cache, then this will aggravate the number of short prepares. More short prepares will take place. And what we'd like to do is to compensate for that by increasing the size of the EDM prepared statement cache above the bar to reduce the number of full prepares. A full prepare costs much more than a short prepare. Or to put it around the other way, if we can avoid a single full prepare, or as many full prepares as possible, this will more than compensate for a modest increase in the number of short prepares. Now turn to slide 27. We introduce a new option through the service stream in version 8 through APAR PK21861. It introduced a new ZPARM called Cached In Free Local. Now this is actually moving on from the previous tuning option, where what I was talking about was reducing max keep D as a way of reducing the size of the local dynamic statement cache. The problem with the max keep D throttle is it's only considered at commit time. So even if you set max keep D to zero, a perfect zero, that doesn't mean the size of the local statement cache is zero, because basically, if you've got applications that do not commit very often and have lots of SQL statements, then basically the size of this local dynamic statement cache can swell up even with max keep D of zero. And also, when you get to commit time and max keep D is exceeded, it is only statements for that specific thread that are ejected from a local dynamic statement cache. So what we've done is we've introduced this new mechanism to invalidate statements in the local statement cache ahead of commit. In fact, these statements are eligible to be purged or ejected at the end of the section. This new ZPARM has four values, 0, 1, 2, and 3. 0 is the default in version 8, and in version 9, we plan to make the default setting 1, because it's set there as a defensive measure. If you look at the value of 1, what it says is, if the size of the local dynamic statement cache is greater than or equal to 500 megabytes, and the amount of space used in the DVM1 address space is greater than or equal to 75%, then at the end of the section, we will free off the section if it's more than 100 kilobytes in size. Or, if the DVM1 address space used is greater than or equal to 85%, then we will free any statement at the end of the section. And the only difference really between 1, 2, and 3 in terms of the settings are the basic thresholds that cut in. So obviously with a cached-in free local size of 3, setting of 3, this means that once the cache gets greater than or equal to 350 megabytes and DVM1 used is greater than or equal to 75%, then we'll start freeing off large statements. And if DVM1 is greater than or equal to 88%, then we free off any statement. So if you're a customer who makes extensive use of keep dynamic yes, and the local dynamic statement cache is the biggest consumer of storage below the bar in DVM1, then cached-in free local provides a nice mechanism here as a way of freeing off statements earlier to create headroom. But bear in mind here, this is a classic case here of a CPU versus storage trade-off. By ejecting these statements at end of section, this means there'll be more short prepares, which will aggravate CPU performance. Let's turn to slide 28. One of tuning options is to look at the use of release deallocate. Release deallocate can be extremely valuable in reducing CPU resource consumption for very simple transactions when you're reusing a thread. And prior to version 8, and specifically prior to version 8 new function mode, release deallocate was used as a tuning option as a way of reducing XES and false global lock contention in the data sharing environment. In version 8 new function mode, and once you've been through the first group restart after entry to version 8 new function mode, then data sharing is put to a thing called locking protocol 2. So the strong recommendation before to use release deallocate for data sharing has been rescinded. So now, once you're in version 8, I think you need to think about very carefully whether or not you actually want to use release deallocate. The use of persistent threads and release deallocate should be used very wisely because storage and the number of threads are precious resources. So do not overuse the number of persistent threads and with the use of release deallocate as well. To take an extreme case here, if you consider a persistent long-running thread where bands and packages that are running on that thread are all bound with release deallocate, you will end up over time accumulating a huge number of statement blocks on that thread, and neither full system contraction or thread storage contraction will free them off. So use of release deallocate is best reserved for high volume and performance sensitive applications at reasonable volume. And we're talking here about OLTP plans and packages. So something like the 80-20% rule applies here. That basically something like 20% of your applications will run release deallocate to get the best performance, and the remaining 80% at low to medium volume will run with release commit. In the batch area, for batch programs, the recommendation is slightly different. If you have long-running batch programs that take frequent intermediate commits, it's a good idea to use release deallocate, because if you don't, every time you get to a commit point, then things like the mechanisms like index look aside, sequential detection, and fast column processes like IPROC all get reset. So it's a good option for long-running batch programs that take frequent intermediate commits to use release deallocate. Now let's turn to slide 29. One of the big opportunities in version 8 for general better performance, but also help with virtual storage constraint, is to, provided you have enough real storage, is to start exploiting larger buffer pools and ESA compression. Let's take them separately. First of all, supersizing the buffer pools. If you can afford to supersize your buffers to larger sizes, fully backed by large real memory, then you have the potential for a much better buffer pool hit ratio. And if you can reduce the number of synchronous I.O. waits, that can reduce DB2 activity time. And if you can reduce DB2 activity time, you can actually maintain the same throughput in terms of workload with fewer threads. Or to spin it another way, with the same number of threads, you can support much higher throughput. So this is a way of reducing the number of threads. And if you reduce the number of threads, you reduce the thread storage requirement below the bar. It's a similar argument here with ESA compression. Many customers were constrained on the use of ESA compression prior to version 8 because the compression dictionaries were very significant at 64 kilobytes each. In version 8, the ESA compression dictionaries go above the bar, and they go above the bar starting even with compatibility mode. So by expanding your use of ESA compression, not only can you achieve less DASD space and faster sequential scans, again, you have the potential here for a better buffer pool hit ratio, and the same arguments apply here of reducing the number of synchronous I.O. waits, reducing DB2 activity time, and therefore needing fewer threads to maintain the same throughput. So you look at typical OLTP applications, as much as 60, 70, 80% of the DB2 activity time is represented by synchronous I.O. waits. So anything that can be used to reduce the number of synchronous I.O. waits can have a beneficial effect here in terms of storage usage. Slide 30. We now have some other options, such as basically trying to reduce the appetite for storage in the extended common areas by getting IMS users to exploit the virtual storage constraint features of IMS Virtus 7, and to avoid situations where extended CSA and other extended common areas are grossly overallocated. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, threads and the associated thread storage is a very precious resource. So particularly, for example, you want to avoid situations where you over-configure the number of long-running persistent threads. Particularly watch out for in the area of WebSphere DB2 applications, which are using many JDBC and SQLJ data sources. Each data source has its own connection pool. And the danger is if you have many data sources, you have many connection pools, and these connection pools are in fact a set of persistent DB2 threads. So avoid having a large number of data sources. If you're a DDF user, large user of DDF, bear in mind that one of the big drawbacks of using Keep Dynamic Yes which is the persistent statement on the thread in the local dynamic statement cache. This prevents the threads from actually going inactive. So even though you might set the ZPALM CMT stat equal to inactive, these connections will not go inactive if the work running on those connections is using keep dynamic yes. And the same thing applies as well if you have open held cursors at commit. Because unless those held cursors are closed ahead of the commit, this will also prevent the connections from going inactive. Slide 31. This is really talking, first of all, about a really old problem as long ago as 1985. But I still see a number of customers making the same mistake. The problem is described in the info APAR 07124. And basically what you would see here is an increase in storage usage in the DBM at one address space, but you would see it in subpool 230, an increase in a small number of megabytes per day, but obviously would mount up over time. And it's caused by the amount of SMF record type 30, subtype 4 and 5, filling subpool 230. The solution is to go into your SMF PalmLive member and to switch detail to node detail for the started task. The only drawback of this is that if you have any accounting programs that are sent into subtypes 4 and 5 or record type 30, these may have to be modified or rewritten to use alternative means. And finally, if you've actually exhausted all other options, then basically if you haven't implemented data sharing, you need to consider implementing data sharing. Or if you are using data sharing, you have to consider either increasing the width of your existing data sharing group and adding additional members, or redistributing existing work over the existing members so you can actually create some headroom. So the whole objective here is basically to grow your capacity horizontally and redistribute and spread user thread workload over multiple members. Now let's turn to slide 32. One thing I want to stress here is the need for preventative service. From time to time, we do get storage leaks in DB2, and obviously these are very important, especially if you're sensitive to storage constraints inside the DBM1 address space. So frequently, like on a weekly basis, it's a good idea to look at info APAR II10817 to identify any new maintenance that's come out related to storage and to make sure that storage is applied onto your system. I also want to highlight a number of APARs on this chart, where these APARs came out in second quarter this year. And I consider this to be pretty critical maintenance, and I already know that where these APARs have been applied to a customer system, they're actually worth an awful lot of function. So again, I consider this to be critical maintenance, and if you are on V8, I strongly encourage you to apply this maintenance, and if you're not on V8 yet, but you're building a maintenance package, make sure you include these APARs. Now let's turn to slide 33. I want to talk about now protecting the system. I want to avoid situations where Cthread and MaxDBAT are set so high that the system is left undefended. So the basic game plan here is to keep 200 megabytes spare as a basic storage cushion. This is 200 megabytes, which is not going to be used. Our goals here are to avoid hitting the short on storage condition and to avoid repetitively driving the full system storage contraction, whilst at the same time providing some headroom for tuning and growth and other abnormal operating conditions. So what we're going to try and do here is calculate how many threads we can support whilst keeping 200 megabytes spare, and then to set Cthread and MaxDBAT to values that we can afford. The overall game plan here is quite simple. We want to avoid overcommitting the resources, and we want to protect the availability of a DB2 standalone subsystem or a member of a data sharing group. It's better to basically deny the service and queue work outside the system when MaxDBAT and Cthread has been reached, and to try and keep the system alive. Now let's turn to slide 34. On slide 34 are some formula for this basic technique, very basic way of trying to make a cut and estimating how many threads we really can support. Let's go through it very quickly. The working max basically is how much is really available inside DBM1 to use. And basically what you do here is you take the extended region size less the 31-bit extended low private area where the DB2 code sits and a number of data set control blocks, and also this 200 megabytes cushion. The fixed areas is really related to, as it says, fixed areas allocated independent of thread storage. And this is calculated by taking the get main storage below the 2 gigabyte bar and adding the total get main stack storage and the total fixed area. Now, the amount of storage available for the threads is really the upper limit variable. And this is calculated by taking the working max calculated above and taking away from that the fixed areas also calculated above. Next critical piece is to calculate the thread storage footprint. And this can be calculated by taking the total variable storage and taking away from that the total agent system storage and divide through that by the sum of the allied threads and the DBAT. So I want to stress the point here that I've said there, current active DBAT. Now, this scenario where we have to have some pragmatic judgment. In previous presentations I've done, I talked about using the high watermark for the active DBATs. And in some cases, there's a danger of doing that. So in this particular part of the formula here, you either plug in the current value or the high watermark value. The reason why I've specified current there as a default action and underlined it is that what I've seen in many cases now is customers actually have max DBATs set really, really high. So high, in fact, that the maximum number of DBATs never actually gets reached. And customers are also monitoring storage with IFC ID25 outside of the peak period. So in that case, it's very wrong to use the high watermark for the number of active DBATs and the size of the DBAT pool. So the default action, use the current active DBATs together with the allied threads, and add those two numbers together to give you the number of threads that are actually being used. And the final part of the calculation is to estimate the maximum number of active threads that you can support by taking the upper limit variable and dividing through that by the thread footprint. Now let's turn to slide 35. Now this is the picture that I showed you earlier. The green shaded area was the area where basically the data was just simply read into the Microsoft Excel spreadsheet from either the .csv file or the comma delimited file. The area on the right-hand side, the red area, these are the calculations based on that data. These calculations are based on the formula on the previous slide. What you see on the graph here is some of those areas from the IFC ID area 225 data, the green area, and also the red area, and you can see they're actually graphed out. What I've done here is I've highlighted and stressed three particular plots. The green area there, the green plot, is the actual number of threads, which is an addition of the allied threads plus the current number of DBATs. The actual red area is the maximum number of threads. And the blue plot is, in fact, the actual total variable storage being used. So again, what we're doing here is we're studying the evolutionary trend. What you can see that as the number of threads increases, you can see that the total amount of variable storage increases. And on the right-hand side, you can see that when the number of threads actually goes down, the amount of variable storage goes down. So you can see there's a correlation here between the amount of variable storage being used and the number of threads that are being used. And provided these things go up and down in unison, then you haven't got a storage leak. The system is actually recovering the storage over time. In order to estimate the maximum number of threads that you can really support, you have to go for the peak time. There's no point trying to estimate the maximum number of threads in a quiet period. So one of the key things of studying the evolutionary trend is to identify that peak period. So if you look at the time around 9:45, which is the peak of the green plot, that is the maximum number of threads. If you then read vertically going north to cut through the red plot, it tells you how many threads you can really support. So in this case, we can support a maximum number of threads as 423 whilst keeping 200 megabytes spare. So what I'm trying to do here is illustrate for you how to use the IFC ID 225 data to provide additional calculations and then to plot this data to identify how many threads you can support. The closer the current number of threads is to the theoretical maximum, the more accurate the result actually is. The strong recommendation is to focus on the peak period. If you try and do this calculation during a quiet period, there'll possibly be a big gap between the number of current threads and the theoretical maximum, and you'll get a very misleading result in the wrong direction as well. Now let's turn to slide 36. The final topic I want to talk about is real storage usage. Now, as part of our strategy in version 8 of exploiting 64-bit virtual, we moved some of the storage areas above the bar. And those areas actually got fatter as well because of things like 64-bit addressing, Unicode, because they're operating internally in Unicode, and long names. It's very, very important for DV2, both prior to version 8 and in version 8, to avoid excessive page inactivity from auxiliary DASD storage. The recommendation is to keep those rates relatively low, near zero. Now, most people assume the backing rate has to be 100% and dense, for 31-bit storage below the bar, but many people have forgotten about the storage above the bar. That virtual storage allocated above the bar is not free, and one of the common misconceptions is that the backing rate for 64-bit storage above the bar can be less than 10%. This is simply not true. One basically needs to have a near 100% backing rate for storage both allocated below and above the bar. Like I said earlier, we've seen an increase in storage areas below the bar, like stack storage, system threads, and user threads, but we also have to take into account the increased storage requirements above the bar. So whilst most customers will get very big savings below the bar, the total amount of storage, both below and above the bar, will be significantly greater than in version 7. And what we've seen in many cases has been a significant growth in the total reasonable storage demand. Some of that has been caused by over-user allocation of these areas above the bar, but also because of overzealous use by DB2 itself and some defects related to DB2. Let's turn to slide 37. Again here I've got some very critical maintenance that applies to both DB2 and also to ZOS. Again, this is relatively recent maintenance, and all customers on version 8 should apply this maintenance as a way of reducing the demand for real storage. If I can quote one customer example here, one of my customers in my social circle migrated to version 8, and they observed that the increase in real storage was 70%. By just applying this maintenance on this slide, the increase in real storage was reduced from 70% down to 40%. When I then went and analyzed why it was increased as much as 40%, I found that at least 10 to 15, 20% of that memory was related to over-allocation of the new storage areas above the bar, such as the EDM DVD cache and the EDM prepared statement cache. These were grossly over-allocated, as was the new pools for 8K and 16K pages. So please watch that. Let's now turn to slide 38. So what I want to do here is to take a stab at trying to estimate what the impact is on real memory in version 8. So what I would suggest you do here, you must have the critical maintenance on, but the first thing I suggest you do is to factor out to start with the fixed areas like buffer pools above the bar and the EDM pool areas above the bar. What you should assume is that virtual equals real, and the first thing you should do is concentrate on the virtual area below the bar and apply the rules of thumb I gave you earlier in the presentation, like stack storage increasing by 100%, system threads increasing by 40%, etc., and estimate how much virtual memory you would need below the bar and what the increase is over version 7. That increase below the bar equates to the increase in real memory attributed to virtual areas below the bar. Then we'll need to consider those areas above the bar related to threads, and my current estimate would be to allow 1 megabyte per active thread. This is a little pessimistic, but it's the best planning guidance I can give you at this moment in time, is to allow 1 megabyte above the bar for thread storage. So far now, we've talked about storage requirement below the bar, virtual, and what the increase is. We've talked about the increased virtual requirements above the bar, so we need to add those two areas together. And then finally, we need to add back in the buffer pools and the EDM pool, and that way we are able to assess the total real storage requirement in the DDM1 address space, and also the delta relative to version 7. Clearly, this applies to the DDM1 address space. It doesn't apply, for example, to the IRLM address space. In most customer situations, the amount of locks in the IRLM address space are relatively low, and therefore it is the DDM1 address space that drives the prime driver in driving the increased real storage requirement in version 8. However, if you're a customer who has a large number of concurrent locks being held in IRLM, then it is possible that the IRLM address space itself could be very significant. So, for example, in version 8, with IRLM 2.2, the size of a lock request, or control blocks, increased from about 260 bytes to 540 bytes. So if you do have a large number of concurrent lock requests, you may want to do that calculation and assess what the increased storage requirement is for IRLM as well, and add that into the increased requirement for DBM1. Now let's turn to slide 39. What I'd like to do now in this slide and the follow-on slide is to summarize the presentation. This is exactly the same chart I showed you earlier, and what it shows you is that for the vast majority of customers, version 8 will deliver significant virtual storage constraint relief. It will not eliminate the problem, but it will allow you to have more threads in many cases, and in some cases, you'll be able to turn off things like thread storage contraction and the first-fit algorithms. There are some special cases shown by those two customers on the right-hand side. We're using large amounts of data space buffer pool on version 7, using large numbers of persistent threads with release deallocate and or key dynamic yes. With that combination, where you may actually get into a very special situation and see negative virtual storage constraint relief. But I also gave as part of this presentation a technique to project the version 8 usage from the version 7 statistics trace. Now let's turn to slide 40. So as a way of summarizing this, what I tried to do in this presentation here initially was to describe the DBM1 64-bit virtual memory map, to talk about the virtual and thread storage usage within those areas, talking about how to project version 8 usage from the version 7 statistics trace. I delivered some key intermediate messages in terms of planning and also monitoring for the future. We recapped on the problem of DBM1 storage shortage and what the driving factors were. Most importantly, we talked about how to monitor and understand the storage usage. Spent a lot of time talking about the tuning options. And then finally, we talked about how to protect the system by calculating how many threads we could support and setting C-thread and max-dbat to defend the system. And the very last topic we talked about was real storage usage on version 8 and how to project that version 8 real storage usage. So what I'd like to do now is just wrap up this presentation, hand over to the moderator so we can have the actual Q&A session, and thank you very much for your patience and attention so far. Thank you.
Hello?
Thank you. And a question and answer session will be conducted electronically. If you'd like to ask a question, please do so by pressing the star key, followed by the digit 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. We'll proceed in the order that you signal us, and we'll take as many questions as time permits. Once again, it is star 1 on your touch-tone telephone to ask a question. Our first question comes from Doug Medland from IBM.
Yes, good morning. Just back on slide 14, I understood that that vstore parm in RMF could have potential hangups in DBM1. Is that true? I was told not to use that RMF parm when monitoring virtual storage.
Good morning, Doug. Just going to slide 14 myself to just look at it there. That's the RMF vstore command.
Yes.
The only potential issue about that vstore command and studying the private address space is potential system overhead, and that is advertised clearly in the RMF book. However, if all you're actually going to do is just run this for a subset of your address spaces, i.e. the DBM1 address space, then the overhead of actually running this is actually very, very small. It's not significant. And I'm not aware of any issues whatsoever with this regarding, you know, the stability of the system. So I don't view this as a threat to the stability of the system. And if all you're going to do is specifically run this vstore report just for specifically for the DBM1 address spaces, the system overhead is pretty small, tiny almost.
Thank you.
And as a reminder, it is star 1 to ask a question on today's conference. Again, star 1 for questions. We have John McCowan from State of Ohio.
Hi, good presentation.
Thanks, John.
Just a starting point, where should we start the 8K and 16K buffer pools at?
In terms of the actual size of them?
Yeah.
Well, I think you need to start these things at about at least 1,000 buffers, okay? But I think at the end of the day, there's a general buffer pool tuning recommendation here. Assuming the normal mix of random and sequential pages, the thing to do is to actually monitor the page residency time.
Right. Just needed a rough idea where to start them at.
Yeah, so I think, you know, with all these buffer pools, I think starting at 1,000 pages is a reasonable way to start. Obviously, though, when you go to the 16 and the 32K page buffer pools, you know, I'm making a general comment here, then you might want to start lower, like, you know, about maybe 200 or 500, simply because with the multiplier of a 4K size, right?
Sure.
4 and 8K, you may end up actually consuming a lot of storage. But basically what I would do here, assuming a normal buffer pool, which is a mixture of random and sequential pages, I'd monitor the average page residency time. And I would look for either wild swings either way. If that page residency time was down into a small number of seconds, that's an indication that buffer pool is under real pressure. And on the other hand, if it went into many minutes, way beyond 5 minutes in terms of the average page residency time, It may well be that you've actually over-allocated that buffer pool.
Thank you.
Okay.
Our next question comes from Harry Shanmugadasha from Harry's Database Analysis.
John, on FOIL 38, in terms of real storage usage, in terms of below the 2 gigabyte line, you talk about, you know, virtual equals real, and also in the last sort of formula, it says add back the fixed areas, which include the buffer pools. So the way I interpret this is that essentially, you know, for the buffer pools and all those fixed areas, virtual equals real. And therefore, it sort of seems to imply to me that, you know, from a hardware planning point of view, I should have that real memory, and therefore I should be using long-term page fix for all my buffer pools because I have the real memory to back that up and to protect my DB2 DBM1 address space from some nefarious other address space that hasn't done their memory planning. I should be defining that address space as storage critical so no one steals any pages from me. Is that a correct interpretation?
Hello, Harry, I don't feel altogether comfortable about that interpretation of it. The one message I wanted to give, basically, and it was true when people even went to data space buffer pools running in a 64-bit real environment, if you are running in a virtual equals real environment, so let's just take the version 7 picture here, you should have been running in a virtual equals real environment, because if you were splitting to auxiliary, and specifically if you had significant page inactivity, then you would really be suffering potentially badly from a performance viewpoint, because in version 7, the buffer pools, you know, weren't page fixed. There was no option to do that. And then basically, if you had overcommitted the real memory, then basically you had a double I.O. every time you did an I.O. You had a page in from auxiliary because of the page fault, and then you had the real I.O. to bring things in, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're okay so far with this?
Yeah.
Now, let's now look on to version 8. Page fixing and page freeing, you know, buffers are quite expensive, particularly in a 64-bit environment. So clearly this is one of the performance tuning options you can use. But for example, it can be dangerous because a lot of customers, and quite rightly so, they run multiple DB2 subsystems in a test environment, and they make a conscious decision to overcommit the real memory in this development environment. And that's perfectly okay to do that. But if you have made that conscious decision and you start putting on long-term page fix, and particularly on all the buffer pools, then basically what you're doing is you're actually sort of fencing the storage for the DB2 buffer pools, the real memory, and then you're going to force everything else to trash. And things like CICS, for example, if the QRTCB starts to page, that would be really bad. So the message from a production environment, particularly aimed at the production environment here, is you should plan on a virtual equals real environment. And if basically you don't have enough real memory, then first of all, you shouldn't be using long-term page fix. And the second thing is you ought to be looking at ways of reducing the demand for real. And obviously from purely a DB2 perspective, the thing to do is to reduce the buffer pool size. But if you have got the real memory to actually back this up, okay, which you should have, then the thing to do is to target what you want to do. And basically, you know, if you want to the 80-20 rule on this sort of approach, what you do is you go after those buffer pools which have the highest I.O. intensity. It's got nothing to do with get page rate whatsoever. It's all based on I.O. intensity. So it's not based on buffer pool size either. It's based on basically adding up 6 counters from the statistics trace and then dividing by the VP size. And you end up with the relative value. The absolute value doesn't matter because it depends on what the interval is you're actually going to measure this over. But if you end up over a particular interval with a big spread of values here ranging from, I don't know, I'm just going to make this up, right, 100 on one hand, 20 for another, 5 and 1, then clearly the buffer pool that has the 100 value is the one that will get the greatest benefit. You also have to bear in mind as well that in a real customer environment, things are not running in steady state. It's not a benchmarking workload. And there may be situations when dumps occur or other systems on there may overcommit the real memory. So it's something that you need to watch, but certainly long-term page fix is incredibly valuable, and you need to target it at those buffer pools, particularly those that are doing, you know, the I.O. intensity. Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
All right, next question is from Mary Sert from IBM.
Hi, John.
Yeah, hi, Mary.
On slide 4, I just have one real quick question for you. You're indicating this is your 64-bit virtual memory map. On the space above the bar, we've got some IRLM lock space. In version 7, how significant is that?
In version 7?
Yeah, you say IRLM locks in the DBM1 address space. I know the predominant storage is in the IRLM address space.
Okay, yeah. So, Mary, this is embarrassing for me, right, on this chart. It's only because I've actually put the title on the top of being the 64-bit memory map. The IRLM locks don't go anywhere near the DBM1 address space, okay?
Okay, that's what I thought, but yeah, I thought maybe I was learning something new here. Okay.
Yeah, so I apologize to everybody about that. It's just that I reused a chart I had before and put a different title on there. Basically, in version 7, the IRLM locks are actually going to go into extended CSA with peace equals no, or they're going to go into the extended private area of the IRLM address space. If you've got, you know, PC equals yes. The difference in version 8, of course, is that IRLM version 2 release 2, and basically PC equals yes is forced, and basically not only do the IRLM locks go out of ECSA, they're forced above the bar as well.
Okay, so on this particular chart, you really meant this for the IRLM address space then?
Yeah, those IRLM locks would have going above that bar there is just for the IRLM address space.
Okay, thank you for the clarification. Thanks.
Our next question is from D.D. Smith from Principal Financial Group.
Hi, this is actually Michael Hirsch from Principal Financial Group. D.D. had to step out. But on slide number 27, you were speaking of the cash dime free local and it's when it takes effect. You were speaking of at end of section. Could you elaborate more on which section you're referring to, please?
What I mean by end of section here is basically the section as in the plan section. So, you know, if it was an insert statement, it's at the end of that insert statement. But if, for example, it was a cursor operation, you've got the open, the fetch, and the close, which is part of the same section.
Okay.
And the key point about this, just to emphasize, I'm just taking the opportunity of your question, is that a lot of people, a lot of types of systems, are using the keep dynamic yes. And the two big ones I drew attention to in the presentation was one, WebSphere and JDBC.
Mm-hmm.
And the other example is SAP. And the thing is, we only throw away statements out of that local cache at commit time. And so
right.
At commit time, we look at max keep D, and are we over the top of it? Yes. And if we are, we only eject statements off that particular thread. And what we discovered, that even if you're really aggressive and drive max keep D down to zero, then basically, if you've got units of work that do not commit very often, you still end up with a very large, potentially, local dynamic statement cache.
Right.
So the real goal of this new parameter, which came in through the service stream, is basically you can think of it as yet another reserve parachute. That basically if you are under extreme pressure, then what we'll do is we'll eject those statements out of the cache ahead of commit at the end of that section. So that's what the attempt is. It's yet another attempt of a reserve parachute. And if you do run into this, i.e. hit those thresholds, then clearly this is another example of a CPU versus storage trade-off.
Right, and when this option takes effect and a statement is ejected out, does the application get the -551 or not? It doesn't, does it?
No, there's no. This is application transparent.
That's what I thought. Okay.
But what I've seen, for example, in some of the SAP systems and SAP benchmarks, I've seen areas where this thing has swelled up to over 500 meg or more, and basically this becomes the dominant factor in the storage consumption below the 2 gigabyte bar. And so the thing is, if you were to go as far as changing the bind option from keep dynamic yes to keep dynamic no, that would not be application transparent. So in order to benefit from keep dynamic yes, you have to change your application to avoid driving prepares on subsequent units of work.
Right.
Just changing the bind option doesn't help you. In fact, basically the applications will break.
And you had mentioned that under version 9, a 1 would be the default option. Is 0 then an option, or is it totally unavailable?
No. The options are still there. It's just that we're going to make the option. But what we try to do when bringing these options in is just try to avoid no change to start with. You can think of it as a chicken switch, if you like. But then what we want to do, after it's been out there, is then on the next release, make it a sensible default.
Right.
And clearly, you know, when you've got it to 1 here, I mean, you're saying basically the cache, you know, has to be greater than 500 meg, which is really massive, right? Mm-hmm. And you're already dangerously close to hitting the top of the address space, even at 85%. So this is a pretty intelligent default, I think.
Okay, thank you very much.
Cheers.
And if you'd like to ask a question, again, it is star 1 on your touch-tone telephone. Star 1 on your phone. We have a question from Gordon Rolick from Bank of America.
Yes, quick question. Do you have any thoughts, recommendations about the impact of using DB2, ZPARM, ACCU, MACC?
What was it again? ACU?
Yeah, ACUMAC. It's supposed to consolidate SMF type 101 records?
Well, I think, I mean, obviously it's not really related to this particular subject, but I think, you know, in a number of customers, the reason why we've introduced this basically is people are concerned about the amount of SMF data volume being generated. And so this is, if you like, one of the tools or even weapons basically as a way of doing it. And several customers are using it quite successfully. It all really depends, really. If you're happy to do the accumulation, that's great. The only thing is if you want to then, you know, break down and look at it at a very detailed level, then you need to have the individual trace records. A lot of people are already using this because they actually want to have, you know, the roll-up and to cut down on their SMF data volume.
Okay, thanks.
And we have a follow-up from Harry Shanmugadasha.
John, in FOIL 25, when you're talking about the ZFARM MinStore, you have a bullet that says the danger is that it masks storage leaks. It makes them appear to go away. And in a later FOIL, the one where you're showing the graphs of usage, you made a comment that you expect the two lines to sort of move up and down in sync, and if they don't, that's a sign that there's a storage leak. Does the bullet that the danger is that it masks storage leaks, is that's not true if you have MinStore, yes?
No, not at all. I think I was too subtle about that point in the presentation. But basically, often what happens is that people, either talking to our level 2 or looking at some of my presentation material, see these tuning options as like golf clubs in a golf club bag, right?
Mm-hmm.
And just take them out one at a time and try and hit the ball. And sometimes you get lucky. The fact is that customers, you know, these days, you know, availability is so important, continuous availability, DB2 substance is up for a week, a month, even multiple months at a time. And so in a number of cases, people have found themselves running out of storage. Basically, haven't really understood the underlying thread, and they put MinStore on there. And so it looks like MinStore is this magic, you know, golden tool that you've just used, and the problem goes away. In fact, in most cases, it's not gone away at all. All it simply does, it reduces the speed of the storage leak, if you like. It makes it shallower. And if you still run long enough, basically, then it will actually emerge itself. So it's giving you some, it can appear to give you headroom, but the underlying leak can be there. So I always prefer that if we've got a storage leak, let's identify this, let's get the documentation to shoot it. And what I prefer to do is just use MinStore as the option of last resort. When everything else, when I feel comfortable about everything else, the system is not working normally, recovering storage, then I throw the MinStore on. So that's the only danger about it. I'm purely from a, you know, a product viewpoint. If there's a defect there, you want to identify it and basically get it fixed for that customer and for any other customer. The point about slide 35 is that when you know, a lot of people are very comfortable now about creating this spreadsheet and producing the pretty picture. But the thing is, we know what you do with it after you've created it. And the fact is, systems do not run in steady state. And if you just look at an individual snapshot of the system, you can't tell whether there's a storage leak. I certainly couldn't. And what you have to do is it's all about the historical evolutionary trend. And basically, you know, as threads come and they go, storage will go up and it will go down. But, you know, if you're studying the storage over several days, and the peak is obviously got a peak and a trough in every day, but if you're seeing the peak is going up day on day, you know, for every day in the month, basically, then you have to ask yourself why. Now, one reason could be that your business, you know, just happens to be cyclical in the sense that it's following this pattern, and it goes up over the month and it peaks at the end of the month. That's possible. The other possibility is it may take a few days for the system to stabilize. So if you recycle DB2, it's a bit like doing Control-Alt-Delete on Windows, you've rejuvenated the system. And until such time as you've been through most of your application processing cycle and been through at least the peak period, it's going to take several hours, maybe even several days for it to stabilize. So what you're looking for on this graph here is basically to see whether, you know, the storage goes up, does it eventually come down when the number of threads goes down? And when you study over the whole month, if the trend is cyclically, you know, this sine curve, if you like, or sawtooth curve, is actually going up all the time, and yet the maximum number of threads, you know, during these peak periods is roughly the same, then it's indicative that you've basically got a storage leak. And the final point I would say is if people don't keep this 200 megabyte spare, this approximate value, you know, my creation of this Bakey's storage cushion, the problem is that you don't know whether you've got an overuse situation or whether you've got a leak. So you've got to have some buffer on the top that you can monitor against. Otherwise, you really, as I said, you don't know whether you've got a leak on your hands or an overuse. Does that answer the question?
Yes, thank you.
Our next question is from Rich Fisher from Thrivent Financial.
Yes, if you could... I think I learned something new. I heard a parameter called AccuMac. I'm not familiar with that. If you could expound upon that just a bit and let me know how I can find out more about that.
Well, if you go and look in the VA install guide, you'll see a description in there of it, and it's related to actually rolling up accounting records for, for example, DDF-type workload and other types of workloads. So what I suggest is you go and look in the VA install guide, which you can go and browse over the web. You just go and Google it. Why don't you just go and Google it, and you'll be able to find an entry on the install guide.
Sounds great. Thanks.
Again, if you have a question, it is star 1 on the touch-tone telephone, star 1 on your phone. And at this time, we have no further questions. I'd like to turn over to you, Mr. John Campbell, for any further comments.
I'll just give you a few more moments to think of whether you've got any more questions. I'd like to thank everybody for dialing in for this session. I hope it was useful. If you think of some questions afterwards, then please drop me an email with the question. I'll just say if there's one last opportunity here, if anybody's got any questions. And if not, then, well, I'd say thank you once again and hand it back to the coordinator to close the session down. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, John. Hello, everyone. This is Verna Dunmoody, and I'm with IBM Software Group Enablement. Diane had to drop off early, but she asked me on her behalf to thank everyone for taking out time in your busy schedules to attend the Virtual Storage Release in DB2 Version 8 What to Expect call. A special thanks goes out to John. Thank you so much, John, for being our speaker today. If you have any additional questions, as John said, please shoot him a note, or you can contact Diane, and she'll be glad to put you in touch with a DB2 for Z sales rep or a DB2 for Z technical advisor. Also, this concludes our DB2 for Z customer teleconference series for this year. But in January, we will be back. If you have any suggestions for future topics, please don't hesitate to contact Diane or send those suggestions to her. So goodbye for now, and everyone have a great day.
This does conclude today's conference. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.